The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Now, Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
I presume you gave the Taoiseach a bit of advice on his way out.
I did. I had a chat to him. Very nice. Yes, we compared notes. You know, nice to meet him, actually. I never met him before. He said I lectured to him, actually, when he was in medicine all those years ago, but hadn't met him in person since then.
Now, let's talk about the news of yesterday. The Moderna vaccine finally gets the go-ahead. We'll have just over 100,000 doses of it available in the first quarter. Why is it so slow? Have they not been manufacturing just like AstraZeneca and Pfizer BioNTech have been doing in anticipation of approval?
They were, yeah, but not to the same scale. But they're not a big drug company, Moderna, remember, Pat. They're quite a small one on the world stage, whereas Pfizer are huge, as are AstraZeneca. They've got massive resources and all kinds of ways to make things quickly, you know. So Moderna are just slightly behind. But, of course, they're ramping up now. I mean, they're saying they can increase production. It's not trivial, Pat, to make 500 million doses of a vaccine, remember. It's a big ask, you know. So, but Moderna are catching up. They will become a dominant player. I think AstraZeneca could well be the ultimate dominant player, though, in the long run, because they have massive capacity like Pfizer, you know. But all three now, it's great, isn't it? I mean, now we're waiting for AstraZeneca. It's like we're knocking them over one by one, aren't we? AstraZeneca should be next. And as you know, the German health minister is putting pressure on the EMA to get AstraZeneca approved. So we can anticipate in the next few weeks we'll see AstraZeneca come along next.
Now, just remind our listeners, because you've talked about this before, the difference in the handling of each of these. You know, is Moderna going to be easier in terms of distribution than Pfizer and AstraZeneca, even more user-friendly?
Exactly, yeah. So there's a rank order. And AstraZeneca would be the most convenient of all three. It keeps in the fridge. You don't need to keep it ultra-cold. Moderna is an RNA vaccine like the Pfizer one. That does need to be kept cold at minus 20. But again, it's a bit more stable, so it's a lot less onerous than Pfizer. But meanwhile, Pat, I heard yesterday, I was on a big call yesterday about the vaccine program in the world, and Pfizer are getting better. They will make a form of that one that's going to be very stable. You know, a thing called freeze drying is done, actually, when you can freeze it, you can dry it and freeze it and then reconstitute it, and that keeps, again, at more reasonable temperatures. So all of them are going to eventually make one that's very efficient. But for this phase, Moderna is a bit more feasible to use, really.
Yeah, and we're waiting then for AstraZeneca, which will be really user-friendly. Now, the UK have been doing projections on what vaccination of various cohorts would do to the death rate.
Yeah, this is extremely important, but in a way that that's modelling. So again, we take it with a slight pinch of salt because it's based on predictions and statistics and so on. But it's a really important study, because what they've said is if the UK vaccinates the top four priority groups, that they're like us, they have a list of priorities. If the top four get vaccinated, there'll be a 90% impact on the death rate, which is huge, you know. And if you vaccinate the top nine in that group, there's a 99% decrease in the death rate. And they can predict this, you see, based on the efficacy of the vaccine and the number of people in each group who had died over the past, say, 7-8 months, and those people now will no longer die. So yet again, Peter, rams home the message, get the vaccine into people's arms as quickly as we physically can, because this modelling suggests and strongly suggests that the death rate will begin to plummet, which is what we want. You know, so it's I think it's a really important study.
And just looking, you've sent me the groupings that they have, the top grouping, residents in care homes for older adults and their carers. That's group one. But by the time you get to group nine, it's people age 50 and over.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, so once you get to that point, you have a 1% death rate compared to what you have now.
Exactly, and there's really good numbers here. They know the number of people who've died, tragically, of course, in each group. So 36% of deaths in the UK, which is 23,000 people almost, were people in care homes over 80s were really important in that group as well. And then once you begin to vaccinate those groups, the top two groups are people in care homes and of course the people who work in the care homes, and group two is anybody over 80 in the community. You know, so you go outside the care home now. Mm. Those two groups combined, it's about 2/3 of the deaths, you see. So again, if you just cover those two, you're going to decrease the death rate by 2/3. And as you say, you ramp down, then 75 to 80 year olds, it's about 10% of deaths, for instance, in the UK are in that group. And we know overall, over 65s are responsible for 75% of the deaths from this virus. So again, if we vaccinate everybody over 65, you'll see a 75% decrease in the death rate, is the idea, you know. And those numbers are now stacking up, you see. So now it's just a question of getting it into all these different groups.
Now, we've been talking about testing, and I myself have used the antigen test just to check things. I haven't put myself in harm's way, but, you know, I have some antigen tests which I'm using routinely just for reassurance, I suppose. Not going anywhere, so that's not the point. But in the University of California in San Diego, they're using PCR testing, but they're using it in quite an unusual way.
Well, yet again, it strikes me, Pat, that this is what we should be doing, you see. So what's happening in that university, they've really ramped up testing there for the students. That's the first thing, right? And what they've installed 11 vending machines on the campus. And a student can go up to the vending machine, scan in their ID card, a little thing pops out of the machine, the swab, and you stick it into a drop box. And then within 12 hours, Pat, the result comes back as positive or negative. Isn't that remarkable? And it's free to all these students. They're doing 2,000 a day on that university alone in this way. So what a fantastic example of, you know, high throughput testing, I guess. And it can be done through vending machines. Now, when I read that, I thought, why aren't we getting all these vending machines? And that's obviously logistically difficult to make all these vending machines. But it just shows you how you can have high throughput, rapid testing is now feasible more than ever, you see.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know the way we're expected to check in, and if you have a bag, you have to deposit it yourself when you're flying nowadays. Like, we do all the work. They fly us, but we do all the ancillary work. In a way, you can get people with a little bit of education and clear instructions to do a lot of the work on testing themselves.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And you just need guts to do it, Pat Reed. No more than the mask issue, as I think you were discussing with the tallest. There was reluctance initially. Can it work? And will we be bothered? And will there be issues with it? It's the same with testing, you know. If we just bit the bullet and got widespread universal testing established, that would have a huge impact on this virus, as we know. And then the antigen testing, as we've discussed, is the way to do it as well. But there's an example of a university decides itself. Now, by the way, the test is done in the university lab because they've got a lab in the university, as we would in Trinity, by the way. You can do the PCR test, really, you know. So some of it's done in the university itself. But there's ways to have local testing. As you say, it's the person themselves then who sort of takes charge of it in a way, you know. And again, as you and I have discussed, the testing weapon is a key one to deploy.
Now, coping with the winter lockdown, you know, people get quite depressed. The days are shorter, the blue skies are scarcer. But there are ways of coping.
There are. And this is very useful, I think, because, as you say, it's not like it was back in March and April. As you may remember, the weather was great for those 2 months and it was the first lockdown. And even though it was difficult, people will look back on it and go, oh, we got through that. But in the winter, it's a different story because, as you say, it's so dark and cold. We have the hope of the vaccine, of course, which gives us a bit of succor, doesn't it, in this time. But there's again, it's the same guidelines, funny, because it's worth reminding people exercise becomes all important. Any kind of sunshine, get out into the sunshine, even though it's weak. You know, that's one strong recommendation, obviously. And the exercise is so important, just to reiterate. I mean, even there's a study showing even 15 minutes of exercise is good for your immune system. It's enough to give you a little bit of a kick because your blood flow is better. The blood is now churning through your veins, you know, and the immune system likes that. So remember, people should be reminded, keep taking a bit of exercise out in the fresh air if possible. It's okay to do in your house as well, by the way. So that's one thing to keep reminding people. But a second fact that I love is Zoom is tormenting many people, me included, by the way. I've about 3 Zoom calls a day. But Zoom has actually got much better in various ways. And you can now do a murder mystery by Zoom. Isn't that tremendous, Patrick? If you search for this, Zoom murder mystery, you will find a murder mystery puzzle on Zoom with people that you can join in. The Macmillan Cancer Centre in the UK, for instance, organises a murder mystery, and it's a way to raise funds for cancer as well. There's life drawing by Zoom, there's pottery classes. So I would recommend people who are on Zoom and looking to sort of entertain themselves or educate themselves, go on Zoom in all kinds of creative ways. So it's a good example of how Zoom has advanced, I suppose, over the last few months.
Yeah, and all sorts of concerts and virtual visits to museums available online. So there's loads of things that you can do. And of course, you could self-improve. You could teach yourself a language. You could teach yourself to play the guitar.
Exactly, yeah. I think the concerts are great. Live streaming is getting more. So obviously, musicians have been in big trouble, as we know, in theatres and all kinds of things. You can now look at live events through live streaming. And if you go online and search, you will see concerts every day that you can look at on your computer now for almost any musical act you like. And then, of course, we saw the pantomime was live streamed. So again, that's the second thing you can do, is just do live streaming, really, is important. And as you say, Pat, in other words, the possibilities have grown since the previous lockdown, if you will. There's much more things available now to keep you occupied and entertained and educated.
Okay, I want to continue this conversation about how to cope with this winter lockdown and the short days by creating winter routines. But we'll take a break and resume with Professor Luke O'Neill after this. Mark in Cork says, bottom line is a percentage of people in Ireland of all ages ignore the rules without any personal consequences, but massive consequences for the rest of us. And I'm asked by another texter to ask Luke why they could not use antigen testing for sixth year students and the staff and kids with special needs regularly. Surely that should have been part of the return to school plans for those cohorts, Luke.
Yeah, 100%, but absolutely, because these antigen tests are much more reliable. Even if there's a slight false positive, as you and I have discussed, that's okay. You can live with that, you know. Absolutely, this antigen testing should be rolled out in the schools. That's the place to start in some ways, schools and workplaces, you know, and then go to every household ultimately. But that's a really good point.
Another one says, social distancing and washing hands are only indirect ways to prevent transmission. If you can determine that no one in the room has the virus, then these are not necessary. So focus should be on rapid testing. That way everything can open up. We've said that again and again. Anyway, back to our winter routines, Luke, for people who are just bewildered by all this time they might have to spend at home, particularly if they can't work from home. You know, how to fill the day.
Yeah, and that's it. And it's very important. We're going to be in this situation probably for 6 weeks. I don't know what the time she said earlier. I wasn't listening to the whole thing, Papa. It could go on till the middle of February. So we've got to just plan for that. And remember, the vaccine is coming, to keeping that in mind. And routine turns out to be extremely important for our mental health. And the big advice is try and maintain a daily routine. And if people work from home, have a little commute of sorts. It turns out that there's another study showing commuting is sort of good for you in a way, because you have a time to think if you're on the Dart or the Lewis or whatever, and then you arrive at the workplace and then you commute back home again. If you're working from home, go for a 20-minute walk around the block, and that's a bit like a commute, if you know what I mean. And then establish routines during the day seems to be a really helpful thing to do.
So even after you've had your breakfast and before you sit down at your screen to work, walk around the block.
Yeah, exactly.
It will improve the whole experience. And then coping, if you've got kids at home.
Yeah.
I mean, very difficult to juggle all those balls.
Yeah, all you can do is say, look, it's time limited. This will pass. Keep that in your mind, because then that gives you a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing. And again, sadly, Paddy, screens are our friends. I mean, another one to look at for people listening in, our parents, go onto the NASA website. They have fantastic resources for children, you know, and they've built up that in the last few months as well, because they know this is going on. And again, all the museums, including our own museums, they've got great resources online for kids to do all kinds of things, you know. So again, it's no shame in having our children on these screens for longer in this phase anyway.
Now, the last thing we want to talk about this morning is the future of cities. I know it's not strictly biochemistry, but it's of course related to the pandemic. And there's interesting science about what might happen to cities.
There is. It fascinates me, Pat, this, because working in the city centre myself, and you know, for years, commuting and big office blocks, and it was always seen as a negative that all these people are stuck in offices. It turns out offices are good. That's the first thing. They're good for your mental health in various ways. And the view now is offices actually are places where you build relationships anyway with your co-workers. And there's a massive debate on now, will remote working replace offices, is the big thing. Now, the trouble is, that means the city's hollowed out. And every city in the world now, including Dublin, as we know, is now hollowed out. These massive Facebook and Google offices are now empty, you know, and the question is, how can we get that back in a way, or how do you build that back? One great suggestion, Pat, which was actually my brother-in-law, but I've seen other people suggest since then, why not turn the Google and Facebook offices into apartments for the workers? Do you know what I mean? So in other words, they can work from home, but they're in the building anyway, you know, and then there might be communal areas where they can meet their colleagues occasionally, so that they are working from home anyway, but why not make those into accommodation blocks? And that would bring back the city a bit, you know, and then other places can then reestablish themselves. So, but what I like as well, Pat, is that you do need to meet face to face. That's becoming clearer in the last few months to build relationships. And there's a great phrase about the chemistry of the unexpected, they call it, happens if you meet your fellow co-workers, and then things unexpectedly can happen in terms of ideas and discussions and so on. So the talk now is of to bring back people. Now, when this passes, obviously, this current phase, bring people back into offices again, at least for some of the time, because it turns out to be essential for our mental health and also for the workplace to work effectively.
Now, we can see the reinvention of our own capital city, and it's happening to a great extent in Cork and Waterford and Galway and Limerick. But we can see it very visibly, say, on the Liffey side, where you had, you know, a very busy dockland. But now you've got legal offices, business offices, apartments, all there. So cities do tend to reinvent themselves.
They do. They're very resilient cities over the last 200-300 years. Exactly. Like if you go back 120 years, there were loads of warehouses for things. You know, they got turned into office blocks, for instance. So, and again, accommodation went up in cities as well. Young people want to live in cities, but that's the other thing that's been realised over the past, say, 4 or 5 years. If a young person in their 20s, they want to go and live in a vibrant city. They don't want to live in the suburbs yet, you see. So again, the accommodation part of cities is very, very important too. And by the way, another definition of cities, Pat, is as a place that assembles talent. And if you look at the big cities of the world, they're like magnets for talented people. They want to go and live in the city and work for companies in that city. And again, it must come back to that. And Dublin is well placed, Pat, by the way. That the Docklands are great, as you know, and there's all these ideas to rejuvenate the city centre by bringing the talent back into it again. So it's very much in people's minds at the moment.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that home working was already starting anyway for some cohorts of workers, and that trend will no doubt continue. But in spite of that, before the pandemic, the cities were never busier as places.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they think the video conferencing and the Zooming is, they say, the psychologist says, too transactional. In other words, it's very sort of immediate. It's based on tasks. You're not really building relationships through video approaches as such. Hence, you need to have the actual human contact with each other. So there's no doubt that that will begin to come back.
A question from one of the News Talk listeners. What are the risks if vulnerable people are vaccinated, but myself as a healthy, low risk person choose not to get vaccinated?
Well, the advice is everybody should take the vaccine, you see. Now, obviously, it's voluntary. It's not mandatory in any way. But the more people that get vaccinated, the quicker we get out of this. Now, remember that the first phase is to protect the vulnerable, and that's mission one. But we still need to vaccinate 70-80% of people to really beat this virus. And that will take time because of logistically and the hesitancy issue and all the rest of it. But the strong advice is everybody should get vaccinated. Some people can't be vaccinated, by the way, for various reasons. That's why you need, if you get 80% coverage, the 20% who are left over should be ones who it is impossible to vaccinate. There's various health reasons why some people can't be vaccinated, for instance. They're okay. You give them a pass, if you like. But everybody else should really be taking the vaccine.
Yeah. I mean, the theory is that if everyone's vaccinated or 80% of the population are vaccinated, and the virus is looking around for ways to transmit to somebody and can't find any takers because they're so scarce, scattered among the population.
Exactly.
But I mean, to that fella there, whoever he is, I mean, if you want to take your chance, take your chance. But we have seen now, you know, children as young as 5 or 6 getting COVID-19, some children dying. Certainly it's there among teenagers. We see reports from ICU of young people in ICU. So, you are taking a risk if you don't get vaccinated.
You are, indeed. And then remember, Pat, if these other strains, and then we've seen a couple of strains already, there's a risk of another strain that might infect young people. You see more. And so therefore, hence the need to vaccinate everybody, because we don't know what's going to happen with this virus in the next few months. The hope is it won't change too much, of course. But again, as you just said, Pat, the way out of it is to have widespread vaccination, without doubt.
And the final question is about if this virus is left to mutate in poorer countries of the world, are the rich countries thinking properly about getting rid of it, not just temporarily pushing it out of their countries and into the third world?
Well, that's right. And I mean, people are all over, COVAX is the organisation, but they're very much all over this, because, and they've ordered 2 billion doses, you see, to vaccinate the less well-off countries. That's got to be uppermost in our minds as well. To truly eliminate it, we have to make sure that everybody in the world, I know it sounds like a big ask, but absolute universal vaccination all over the world is needed. And then, by the way, but that might inform vaccination other diseases. If we can get rid of this one, why not the other ones that are still there, remember? So what we're doing here is we're kind of, you know, going down a road that might help us get rid of other infections as well.
All right. Well, a tweet from Catherine. Luke, thank you for reassuring us all and helping to reduce panic and anxiety in the nation this morning. So,
thanks,
Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, thank you very much for joining us.